the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, and this morning, Mary Beth Maziarz and I explore how the trillions of microbes in and around us can shape everything from brain health to longevity. We speak with Brett and Jessica Finley, who have co-written a new book called Microbiome Master Key. That coming up in the first half. And in the second half, I'm joined by local resident, blogger, comedian, and author Jenna Kingsley. She'll be in to discuss her new book, Darcy Dates. It's based on her blog that chronicles the experience of dating in New York City post-divorce. It is really hilarious. Stay tuned for that conversation. We'll be right back after these words from our underwriters. You're listening to The Mountain Life here on KPCW Park City. Welcome back to The Mountain Life. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
And I'm Mary Beth Maziarz.
What if the key to aging well isn't in avoiding germs, but in embracing them? Today's guests, Dr. Brett Finley and Dr. Jessica Finley, a father-daughter duo of scientists, are here to upend what we thought we knew about microbes and health. Brett is a world-renowned microbiologist, and Jessica is an expert in aging and health geography. Together, they explore how the trillions of microbes in and around us can shape everything from brain health to longevity. Their new book, The Microbiome Master Key, offers cutting-edge research and practical tips for living longer and healthier by caring for your inner ecosystem. Brett and Jessica, welcome to the show.
Thanks.
Okay, well, let's start off here, Dr. Brett, Dr. Finley. We interviewed you so long ago when you came out with Let Them Eat Dirt. And the concept, we know that there are good microbes and bad microbes, good bacteria and bad bacteria. It all somehow comes into this big thing called the microbiome. But most of us don't really know what it is and how the good and the bad help each other, hurt each other, cancel each other out. Can you just give a quick overview?
Sure. So the microbiome is basically all the microbes living in and on us. So that includes bacteria. That's the one that we usually talk about, but it also includes viruses, protists, and other single-celled organisms. Basically, all the things you can't see except under a microscope. So these critters are all over our body. They're not really deep inside tissues, but they're, you know, on your skin, in your armpits, they're in your intestine, they're in your mouth, and they just live there. And this is normal. Most microbes are harmless. There's only about 100 bacteria that actually cause infections, things like, you know, you've heard of salmonella causing typhoid fever and then other things, Legionnaires' disease, et cetera. So most of them aren't actually harmful. And what they do is they just live in it. And the numbers are astounding. There's at least as many bacteria living in and on you as there are human cells, and they actually have about 100 times more genes than we have human genes in and on us. So really, we're more microbial than we are human. When you look at it, we're basically a vessel for all these microbes. And the numbers are astounding. If you take a gram of feces, which I know is very gross, which is the size of your fingertip, there's more microbes in there than there are people on this entire planet. So I jokingly say, think of the genocide you do every time you flush the toilet, for example. So there's lots. It's normal. It's an ick factor, I agree, but we now realize these things have a lot to do with us being humans.
Right. And they have a lot to do with the various parts of our body. We're going to talk today about specifically, you know, things like our heart and our brain and how our whole microbiome is has an effect on those things. And Dr. Jessica Finley, the daughter in this duo, I'd love to bring you in and just ask you about how you see in your work in gerontology, as people age, their brains affected by the health of their microbiome.
Yeah, so I'm a geographer. I normally study the places we live, and that's classically, you know, can you go to a park? Can you socialize with friends? Can you get to a grocery store, see a doctor, a pharmacy? I never really thought before doing this book about our microbes, to be honest. Of course, I knew about it from my father and our many dinnertime conversations and lives, but it really didn't factor into the research I do. And I often do qualitative research. So I go into people's homes and neighborhoods and I ask them about their lives. And I started to, as we were starting to brainstorm this book, I kept thinking about the many, many different exposures and lives both people as they aged and their microbes were having. Some homes are, crystal clean with sparkling counters, and you can smell the bleach in the air. Other homes are, unfortunately, there were homes with rotting food on counters. There were, I would go into care environments, and so you have more hospitalized institutional settings where there are necessary cleaning practices. And so it just attuned me to think we're not the only ones here. We have billions of invisible neighbors with us and in us, around us all the time, and they really do have a huge impact on essentially every major body function and system. What's cool about this book, I think, is it really opens our eyes beyond just the gut, which is the classic mecca of microbes that we think about, to their role in the brain, their role in our hearts, their role on our skin, wrinkles, dementia risk. The list just goes on. And so they're intimately involved in all of these processes, especially one of the major ones being inflammaging. So we know that an accumulation of inflammation is not good for us in many ways, that a little bit can help in these immediate circumstances, but this long-term, low-grade systemic inflammation is really, really harmful to our bodies and to our aging processes. And as you see in the book, this is invisible partners of microbes are involved in this. And so really, it is everything, which kind of blew my mind in starting on this process, and really has transformed how I view environments when I go into them and when I study them. And also now there's new avenues of what we can do, given that there's another way to intervene aside from just encouraging someone to see a friend or play a game of cards or, get outside. It's now open your windows because then you're letting in the microbes as well.
Interesting. Invisible neighbors. I love that term. What many cultures have microbiome supporting foods as part of them, kefir, kimchi, different things. Is there anything native to the American diet, which is not very celebrated, that is already in support, or is it just our adaptation of many wonderful other foods from around the world that is going to help us dietarily?
I mean, we have tubers, for example. There are many, whole grain foods, and legumes that are abundantly already grew here before we were here. And so I think there are many foods that can be and are kind of a more traditional way of eating in some ways. I think they're there. We just oft so often in an American culture move towards these highly processed foods for many reasons, complicated and interconnected. And so I think there are absolutely so American foods that support the microbiome, but there also, unfortunately, are many that don't.
Well, we hear a lot about seeking a magic pill in medicine. The microbiome in your book is presented as a master key to health. How does that metaphor fit into the context of your research?
Basically, it's interesting because Jessica said this inflammaging, it's a key process for all the age. And when you're writing the book, basically what happens, as you get older, your microbes get more inflammatory, your gut gets permeable, and your body has this low-grade inflammation. And you could see it in heavier set people with, red cheeks and jowls, and they're the first in line to the airplane to get the steak and the red wine kind of thing. That's not good for us in a sense. And basically the idea is to dampen this inflammation. So whatever you can do to decrease that actually helps in the aging process. And so this could sound a bit boring, but basically we already know what you got to do to help the age, and that is basically eat well. We talked a little bit about diets. I would argue that following something like the Mediterranean diet, lots of fruits, fibers, nuts type thing, that's really important because that enhances beneficial anti-inflammatory microbes and it decreases the inflammation as well as has many other benefits. So that's diet. Exercise plays a key role in enhancing your microbes. You don't have to be a marathon runner, but you should be active out walking, et cetera. That really increases the anti-inflammatory microbes and it is healthy. Social contact is really important. You should be hanging out with your grandkids and your dogs and all that stuff if you can. Wherever you get exposed to microbes, do it. I personally think there should be little kids running through elder care homes all the time and let them defecate everywhere, and that's actually good for the place, kind of thing. So there's social contact. The one that I think we have trouble most in our society is decreasing stress. Increased stress really drives your microbes to the bad microbes, in a sense, the inflammatory ones. So if you can lower stress, you can do this. And then the one we added to this newest version of the book is a whole chapter on sleep. And more it's been recognizing that good sleep is really, especially for brain health, but it allows your body to repair, enhances that. And I didn't even know it when I started writing the book. There's actually some really exciting data on how healthy diet and stuff really improves your sleep. So those five things are absolutely key for longevity. But what this book does is the reason they're key for longevity, one of the reasons is the microbes are heavily involved in all these processes.
Well, can you explain a little about how that process actually works? Like, how does stress affect the microbiome? Does it keep it from multiplying properly, or help us understand how that works? Thank you.
Well, stress has many physiological effects on us, and these like increasing the immune system and stuff. And for whatever reasons, we don't know all the details yet, it basically drives your microbial composition to be basically worse. You know, you have all these microbes living in and on you, and they get bad when you have stress. And then that has bad effects on you. The reason you want good microbes is they basically produce molecules from fiber, something called short-chain fatty acids, and these things actually decrease the inflammation. They're anti-inflammatory and they're better for you. So we'll be the first to admit that we don't have all the details. It's a fairly new field. We're still sorting it all out. But there's no doubt that we know that we can identify signatures in microbes that if they're inflammatory and stuff, we know that's bad for you. And if they're not, we know that's probably good for you.
If you're just joining us on The Mountain Life, we're having a conversation with Dr. Brett Finlay along with Dr. Jessica Finlay. They are talking to us about their new book they've co-written. It's called The Microbiome Master Key. I love every interview that I have where I learn a new word. And thank you. I've never heard of the term inflammaging before, but that's a good one. It really describes what it is. Brett, let's go into something that's near and dear to my heart because I have asthma, is the lungs. And it seems like everything that we inhale can potentially be detrimental for our lungs, especially in today's world. What can I inhale that's going to bolster my microbiome?
That's a hard one. So, you know, I've taught microbiology for a long time, and I used to always teach the lungs are sterile. There's no microbes in there. And then we started to get these ways of identifying DNA signatures stuff. And we started to see the microbe signatures. So there's not a lot of microbes living in your lung. Every time you take a deep breath, you definitely inhale microbes. Most of them are cleared, but there are a few, and there's some lung microbiome, if you want to call it this. There's definitely some microbes living there. These are associated with lung diseases, things like COPD and other things. But what's important to remember is it's not just the lung microbes causing lung effects. It's microbes elsewhere in your body can affect the immune system and stuff, which can then affect the lungs. So there's all sorts of studies about the gut microbiome composition and lung health. And of course, oral health. Smokers and stuff, we know they have a different oral microbes because of the smoking, and this seems to then actually impact later on in terms of lung health. As for your direct question, what do I go and breathe to make my microbes better? I don't have a good answer for that. But I mean, bottom line is do everything you can to help your microbes all over your body, which will actually help your lungs. Jess, you want to say something about air quality and stuff? That's your area.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's sometimes a question of what shouldn't you inhale. So we know smoking, for example, has many poor health impacts. This includes directly inhaling that into your lungs and impacting the microbes that are there and traveling along that pathway with it. We also now live in a world of a lot of bad air quality. We're all in locations, so many of us across both these countries in the world, where we regularly have very poor air quality days. And so I think it's being aware of those, checking the AQI readings, for example, and knowing there are some days where maybe everyone should stay inside or be using air filtered air into the home if possible. Or maybe there's days when more immune compromised or younger children or older family members, folks who might need to be a little more protected. I've certainly had conversations with my my children's daycare, for example, about, hey, it's not a good day. I have children under five. What are your plans? Just so we can work towards being aware of these days and just trying to help as much as we can for reducing those harmful exposures that sadly are just an increasing phenomenon that we live with on a very, very regular basis.
Yeah. You both are in Canada. Is that right?
I actually am in Boulder, Colorado.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Boulder. And then Brett, you're in the Vancouver area, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah. So, you know, I wanted to ask, Mary Beth asked about sort of the right foods, but then a lot of us take probiotics or prebiotics. And well, a lot of, you know, a lot of times we don't really know why. We just know that there's something about gut health in there. And I wanted to ask you, Brett, if you could address that. Probiotics, you know, should we be taking these? Is it part of the microbiome master key?
Yeah, this is one that most everyone asks. And it's bottom line is, so probiotics are live bacteria that you ingest, and you go to a store and you buy these things and you take them. There's usually lots of them in there, you know, millions to billions type thing, and you take these every day. There's no really good clinical data that they actually really do something medically. There's a few small cases, and if you're interested in probiotics, I suggest you just Google the words probiotic chart. And there's this wonderful site that lists all the probiotics, what they are, and what is the scientific evidence that they actually do something good for you. There's some that work for antibiotic-associated diarrhea, so you take antibiotics for diarrhea, some probiotics seem to decrease that. There's some that work in infants for other diseases. But for the most part, they don't really do a lot. And part of that is you think of the biology where these probiotics are coming from. A lot of them are, say, lactobacillus. Lactobacillus is a very common inhabitant of the vagina. The vagina is acidic and there's air. The gut is basic and there's no air. So the reason you take 10 billion of these things every day is because they die and they don't do anything. So right now, there's not a lot of good clinical evidence for taking probiotics. They're not going to hurt you. Go ahead if you like them. The other thing I like to say is that if you want a new pair of runners, you go into a running shoe store and there's these walls full of runners. There's tennis and joggers and hikers and whatevers, and you don't just grab the cheapest pair. And probiotics are the same. Each one is a different microbe and thing. So there are some that work for some things. What is exciting is we're entering a new phase now where we're actually taking microbes from the gut for the gut, mixtures of microbes. They call these things live biotherapeutic products, and adding these tailored microbes to the gut to set up a new ecosystem. And they're going through the FDA and things as a clinical drug, even though it's a mixture of, say, eight microbes. And these are now being licensed for recurrent Clostridium difficile infections, for example, and inflammatory bowel diseases. And that's where the excitement is. Let me add two more things. There's things called prebiotics. Prebiotics are basically microbial food. So these are usually fibers that you take that will enhance for a certain kind of beneficial microbe. Now, you do that when you eat other fibers too, but anyway, they're specifically designed to do that. And there's these things called synbiotics, which is basically a prebiotic and a probiotic both together. You take them both together, and then hopefully you feed the good microbes, and you add the good microbes, and you set up a good microbe type thing. But it's not... And the reason that they're not clinically used that much is because they don't really have to be regulated by the FDA. So you don't have the strict, you know, prove it works in a double-blind placebo-controlled trial type thing. So there's not a lot of good clinical evidence out there for that. So take them if you like to, but I would argue have a better diet and exercise, and I think you're probably better off than the probiotics.
I have a brother with Crohn's disease, and so I kind of keep up on some of the studies about it. And I read a fascinating article a few years ago about a guy who went to India and walked through these waste fields in order to submit his body to these microbiomes that supposedly can help heal the gut. And instead of doing like a fecal transplant or the various things that they do, and at least in this man's anecdotal experience, it was strikingly effective. Do you see a lot of hope in these live biotherapeutic modalities?
Very much so. I think that we're just starting to enter the phase now. We're figuring out how they work. There was just a fabulous paper that just came out yesterday, actually showing, well, we kind of knew that exercise decreases cancers, and basically they sh and then also cancer treatments. And they showed that they've now found this molecule. It's called formic acid that really seems to decrease melanoma formation. And they also showed it both in mice and people and stuff. So now we're getting to the molecules that we know that these things are making, so then we can actually turn those into drugs, for example, or you can put in the microbial mixture. The other problem with probiotics, you only add one microbe and basically pretty much have to replace the whole ecosystem if you want it to work. So that's why these live biotherapeutic products are actually complex mixtures of several microbes. You're putting in a whole new ecosystem to set it up and make it work.
Sorry, Brett, one more question for you. When you mentioned exercise, how does exercise affect the microbiome? Like, I understand if your exposure to things, but how does, besides maybe reducing inflammation, is there anything else?
Well, exercise really drives your microbes to a much more beneficial composition. It really pushes it to, it's much like a good diet. And you don't exercise for whatever reason, it doesn't. Now, you're asking the hard question, well, how does that work? And, does the endorphins you make, do they trigger certain microbes? We don't have all the details yet, but there is no doubt you could take people that exercise and don't, and you could tell what their microbes are and who has good ones and bad ones and things. The problem with the microbiome field is it's just a little over a decade old, maybe 15 years, and we're still trying to figure everything out. We don't have all the answers. And the other thing is freakingly complex. It's not just one microbe, that works in cancer or exercise. It's mixtures. And the other thing is that we all have different microbes. All our microbes are different in every person. There is no one microbe that everyone has, but we know they do all these good things. And so what we know is that one microbe can substitute for another. It's kind of redundant in a sense. And so as long as some microbe is making that molecule, you'll be okay. So that's another thing that we struggle trying to figure this whole field out. It's really complex. So right now, we don't have all the answers. We're starting to figure out what works. There's really good data coming out, but how it's all working, that's still to come, and that's the next generation of researchers figuring it all out.
Well, Brett, we're looking at you and your daughter, and Jessica explained in the beginning how she had to take the kids to school. So we know that she's at least of a certain age. You look like you're about 40, but there's no way you can be
You're
if
too good.
everything. So it kind of just plays into gaining credibility by, our listeners can't see you, but we can. And you have achieved some kind of fountain of youth, but so that in and of itself gives you credibility. Jessica, I wanted to move on to you, because you work in geography and demographics and aging, your final chapter of the book, The Fountain of Youth, is full of microbes. It's the key to health and longevity. We've talked a little bit about this already with, people who age and are healthy and have a good aging process, a good lifespan. Can you expand on this concept of fountain of youth being full of microbes?
Yeah, so we can look at super successful agers, centenarians, super centenarians. These are folks over the age of 100 or 110. And we can see different profiles for their microbiomes and very distinct, healthful, abundant, diverse microbial compositions versus, life takes a lot of turns. So I never want to blame anyone for entering a nursing home, for example. But if we track folks who do enter institutionalized settings or into hospitals, we can see a shift quite dramatically. Dramatically and quite quickly into a more kind of dysbiotic or a not as healthful, bad microbes. I guess we could maybe, it feels strange to call them bad. They're not bad, but anyways, but what I take from it is that there is a, I take hope that there's a lot we could do. As my dad already mentioned, the strategies are not mind-blowing, and they're often quite affordable. My children go through copious amounts of berries, which I spend way too much on, for example. But I also know that those, cheap bananas could do the job as well. Or I know that we can just go for a walk outside and open the door. And so I think that sometimes some of the craze about probiotics or prebiotics or all of these, it can be quite expensive and just not accessible to all of us. Or maybe life takes a turn and you do need to enter institutionalized settings. But there's things you can do. Again, little things like open the window, try to get a varied diet, chat with friends, get outside, swap those microbes, whether you are doing activities together, taking a walk. I think that for me, that fountain of youth idea through the lens of microbes is that we can achieve it. And it doesn't take running a marathon and buying incredibly expensive products. And you know, it's what's your meaning? What's your joy? And if you can find those reasons to get out of bed, get out the door, connect with people you care about, causes you care about, all of those you can see through a microbial lens. And so for me, it's just a really validating way to think, how can we make aging more accessible? Many folks don't have the opportunity to live into their 80s or 90s or hundreds, but there's little things that we can do with a microbial bend to them, I think, to support what we already know is healthful for all of us. Try to eat well as you can, not those highly processed foods. Try to move your body, socialize, try to sleep, try to stress less. Those are little things, big things in many ways, but little actions can really add up to help us all be able to live longer and healthier lives.
Let me add that in the book, we tried to put a whole bunch of lists of things that you can do based on the scientific literature that we know is real. And so this version of the book, it has a whole bunch of basically helpful hints at all stages in terms of what you can do in this. And so much what Jessica is referring to, we try and point, yeah, you can eat this instead of that, avoid high processed foods, for example, and here's why kind of thing, or here's things you can eat kind of thing. So the idea is make it. And the other thing to remember is that you are born and die with the same genes. You can't change your genes, but you can change your microbes. You can change them very quickly. And so this is something you actually have a lot of control about. And they think that healthy aging is about 20 to 25% genetics, about 70 to 75% environment. And when I say the word environment, of course, I'm talking microbes in my biased view of the world. And so there is hope, and you can change things. And so this is sort of a prescriptive way that you can actually take control of 75% of how you're going to age. And it's thought that you can add about a decade of healthy living to the average person if you do these kind of things.
As a means of sort of wrapping up here, Brett, it seems like going back to what's simple, what we all should know, getting lots of fresh air, getting exercise, eating whole food. Is there any other just little takeaway that you would love for our listeners to take with them today?
Well, I would argue that hopefully, after listening to this, you will see the world in kind of a different way and realize that when we're talking about me and you, we're talking about Homo sapiens plus all our invisible partners we have living on us type thing. And to think of the things that you do kind of through a microbial lens. Okay, if I touch this or eat this or kiss that kind of thing, you're acquiring microbes. And I jokingly say that, dating apps should have, microbial analysis as well, kind of thing, because, who you're hugging and kissing and playing with or whatever, you're sharing microbes as well as the joy of companionship. And so that would be my takeaway, is that hopefully we can convince people to see the world. I was frustrated. We don't have any, magic bullet based on the microbes that we never knew this before kind of thing. It's boring. It's diet and exercise and all this, but that's through the microbes now. And I think that gives you the power to do something healthy.
Yeah, I think just making more informed decisions, having the information available. Antibiotics are life-saving and absolutely necessary, but we overuse them. So many times we don't actually need them. They're being prescribed, and we go into detail about times when you do need them and times when you don't need them. Or if you do need them, what can you do? What can you take? What might help you restore your microbes after they get carpet bombed by those necessary antibiotics? Or same with sanitation. We have times when we absolutely need to sterilize surfaces or wounds after surgery or But, do you need to squirt that hand sanitizer? It depends on your circumstance. It depends on the moment, who you are, where you are. And so I think just we can make little decisions that can really add up over time. And it's more this idea of embracing the microbes and understanding all that they can do for us, but also understanding at times we do have to take some actions to help our bodies to stay safe, to stay healthy, and just knowing when to do what to do. We try to provide some of that because it can be really confusing and overwhelming, and there's a lot of different perspectives out there, a highly church world, and so just trying to give you the information so you can make decisions that's best for you and your family and those around you is really one of the goals that we want to do. Provide the science in a more accessible way so you can make decisions that are right for you.
Dr. Jessica Fenley and Dr. Brett Fenley have been our guests. Their new book is The Microbiome Master Key: Harness Your Microbes to Unlock Whole Body Health and Lifelong Vitality. Brett and Jessica, thank you so much for joining us on The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My guest this last half of our show is a local resident and a New York City native. She's a comedian, a writer, and a viral sensation known for turning modern life's quirks into comedy gold. Jenna Kingsley's quick wit and bold humor have made her a standout in the comedy world, using her sharp observations to expose the absurdities of everyday life, like dating. She joins me in the studio to present her new book. It's called Darcy Dates. It's a hilarious and unfiltered dating diary based on her blog of the same name. Her story is both touching and cringeworthy, and you will be cheering Darcy on in her quest for love. Jenna Kingsley, welcome to The Mountain Life.
Thank you so much for having me, Lynn. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. I was dying to know what you looked like after reading your story of dating. It goes back to this blog that you did in 2010, mm-hmm. and you called yourself Darcy, obviously not your real name. Why did you start the blog? What was the impetus? What were the crazy dating stories that you had that said, I have to document this?
So I, got married so young. I was 23 when I got married, and I met my ex-husband when I was in college. So I'd never dated as an adult. I dated as a kid, basically, a college kid. And I was married to a great man, and we're still very close friends. But we got divorced, and I was a young single mom when I got divorced, and I was back in the dating world. And it was totally different dating as a divorced person with a child and dating other people who have been divorced possibly or not. And now there was online dating and the world was totally different. And I had these hilarious stories and I was like, I have to share them. And I was a writer, so I was like, I'm going to write them on a blog under a pen name. So that's what I did. And they're comedic short stories. And there was no, poor me aspect. It was more just entertainment.
It is so quick-witted and so aptly captures the nuances of this wild, weird dating world. And the funny thing is, it's ubiquitous. We've all dated at some point.
Yes.
And if we, I never had to do the whole online dating thing, but certainly I've been through it with lots of friends, trying to help them write their profiles and things like that. And it is just wild. Some of the stuff in your book, it's hard to believe that it's true. And I know it is because
it's all based on a true story. Names and locations have all been changed. So there's, but it is, you can't believe that they're true stories. And people are like, did this really happen? Or, it's similar to any time I have a friend that's dating and I listen to their stories, they're like, you won't believe this. I'm like, I probably will, but try me. And I think that people always invent new ways to surprise people. Just when you think you've heard it all, there's something you haven't heard, which is the beauty of it. There's comedy in all of it.
Did you ever think that some of the chapters that the stories in your book, I think this person must have been trying to put you off. Like maybe they just said, to their friends that they'd, put up a profile on an online or on a site, and then they would just do their best to turn everyone off. It seems that way. It seems...
You would think that, but people, I think the takeaway is people are not self-aware at all. And I think that the things people do every day, they don't realize how ridiculous they are. And I think that that's the thing. The book, the stories, single people who are dating are like, oh, it's not just me. It's not just me with these crazy experiences. Or I get, you know, emails or, you know, DMs from people and they're like, oh, this happened, or, you know, I'm not alone. And then married people are like, is this real? Is this really what's happening out there? So, yeah.
It's a good argument for married people not to question
1,000%
their marriage.
1,000%.
Yeah, or just stop complaining about your spouse.
The grass is not always greener, folks.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of the stories start off hopeful, and I found myself thinking, like, okay, this seems like the guy. You know, she really, like, the things he was saying in the beginning just are so sincere and wonderful. Only to find, you know, in the next paragraph that he does a 180.
Right. People lie about their age. People lie about everything.
Yeah. So I think we all know how people will lie about their age or post a photo of them 15 years ago.
Yes.
You know, 25 pounds lighter, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What else do they typically lie about that make you wonder, why would you ever lie about something like this?
There's so many things. There's people who lie about their jobs. There's people who lie about their marriage status. There's people who, and you learn, right? So over time you learn. You know, when I first joined online dating sites, the book was written in 2010. So this is when there was sites and not apps. And people would say that they lived in Tanzania. You know, they were in New York City, but they'd post their location from Tanzania. And I was like, ha, that's funny. Like I thought people were, you know, trying to stand out and be funny. And then I was like, oh, they just don't want to be found.
Yeah.
They want to find
their
people.
Wife.
They don't want to be found. So you learn over time. And I am good at doing, I became very good at doing diligence on who I was meeting. I'm pretty good at that.
Right. Oh, that's funny. Talk a little bit about your career as a writer and a comedian before, well, now and before you started your blog.
So I graduated with a journalism degree in NYU, and I always liked the creative aspect part of writing more than the journalistic part of writing, because journalists, you have to stay inside the lines, and I was better at coloring outside the lines. And I always did comedy. I did improv. I did comedy. So when I started writing Darcy, it was on a blog, and it was comedy under a pen name, which quickly I got approached to turn it into a television show, and we wrote scripts, and, you know, then we put it to the side. I started doing stand-up actually based on this blog. My manager at the time was like, you should try stand-up, and I was like, that's outrageous, I would never do that. And then I started doing stand-up, and it went well, and from there I started doing these social experiments, these prank videos that went super viral internationally. And I had a podcast. I've always looked at things from a comedic lens. So I think even at my worst moments, I look at things from a comedic lens, and I could find comedy where most people can't. Not most people, but, you know, where some people can't. And so that's kind of been my secret talent, I think.
That's so fun. It makes you be able to sharpen your observation skills about people and what makes us tick.
Absolutely. I think that, well, that's the thing. A lot of my social observations are on things we do as people every day that we're not paying attention to. So my video for Starbucks was, I was a bouncer at different Starbucks in New York City. And I wanted to see if people would wait online and tell them they had to make an appointment like they do at the Genius Bar. So I had a clipboard and a velvet rope, and I said people couldn't come in unless they were on the list. And I got some New Yorkers to wait online, as some New Yorkers were like, what is this? And I told them what time they can come back for their appointment at Starbucks. Starbucks was not in on it.
Did they know you were doing
it? They didn't know I was doing it.
Okay.
Some managers I talked into letting me stay said it was a crowdfunder kickstarting. You know, I talked in circles like any improv comedian would do, and I did get some managers to agree. I did have to leave some locations. But overall, I think it's the observation that what we're doing as people, like we're so reliant on apps that we'll believe someone standing in front of a Starbucks saying you can't come in unless you download the app and make an appointment, right? It doesn't seem that far-fetched because as people, that's what we have to do now. So I think those social observations and observations about people and their behaviors are something that I find personally very entertaining. It's very fun for me to try to find those things. So even in dating, observing, you know, like I went on a date a couple, like years ago, probably like 5 years ago, and I had a podcast at the time, and I said, you know, I went on a date with this guy and he told me that he was lazy. He was like, I'm very lazy. I don't work anymore because I'm lazy. And I thought some people might get upset. And I was like, this is brilliant. Like, he's so honest. It's refreshing. He's honest. And one of my friends made a great observation. She said he bought his 10th date self to the date, which is if everyone could bring their 10th date self, dating would be so much easier, right? So rather than pretend, he just was like, I'm lazy and I don't work. I didn't go out with him again, but I was like, this is so great.
It cuts to the chase. It doesn't waste anyone's time.
It doesn't waste anyone's time.
That's so funny. So if he were to go to his first date, take his first date self to a date, you know, what was he? What was he projecting to be?
I think he was projecting to be, finance guy in New York. And then the truth came out. He's like, I haven't worked in, you know, 15 years, whatever it was. He's like, I'm just lazy. And I, you know, here's the thing. I think some people would be super put off, but once someone says that, I get so intrigued. I'm like, talk to me about it. Like, tell me, like, it's entertaining. And I tell people, if you could go into every date and not bank so heavily on it being the love of your life, and just kind of watch people and just enjoy the experience. Dating could be so much more fun because if you're not putting the pressure on yourself for it to be something, then you could just kind of be entertained by how terrible it is because dating is terrible until you find someone you like.
Right. How often were you turned off by someone, you know, on the first date, but thought, well, okay, I'll go on a second date, and then found a much more appealing person on the second date. You know, like you're talking about this 10th date person.
So I actually tell everyone that if you don't like someone on the first date, but there's something you like about them, give them another chance. I always say that. And all of the long-term relationships that I've had, including my marriage, have been, you know, on the first date, maybe something put me off and I was like, no, this is not my person. And then you're like, I'll go out one more time. And then you do, and you see a totally different side because people can be super awkward on a first date. There's so much pressure. So I actually tell everyone to not toss away a first date. There's a show on TV that I watched. It's like a matchmaker, and her concept is date them till you hate them. And I don't go that far to say date them till you hate them. But if you like someone and you have a good time with them, maybe ignore the fact that they're not your type, or ignore that they're not, you know, your typical person you date, because in the end, that doesn't really matter. If you like someone on the inside, that's all that matters.
Right.
I think.
And it may be a good lesson for you to break out of a pattern that you have.
1,000%, because I have a friend who keeps saying, like, well, he's not so hot, he's not like my type. And I'm like, but your type doesn't work.
Yeah.
Like, look at the history. That's not the guy. So I think that's an important lesson for people to learn.
If you're just joining me on The Mountain Life, I'm having a conversation with Jenna Kingsley. She's a local resident, and she's talking about her book, Darcy Dates.
Yes.
It sprang forth from this very popular blog in 2010 that she wrote about, well, assuming the name of Darcy, but it's all of her true stories.
Yes,
People really said these things. The blogosphere was pretty vibrant by 2010, right?
I'd say the blog world was just kicking off in 2010.
Okay.
And then it really picked up 2011, 2012. But 2010, it was strong in 2010. I think it had just come on the scene, and it quickly gained steam, and people wrote under pen names. And some of my friends till this day or people I met in that world, and everyone only knew each other by their handle, you know, on Twitter or whatever, back when it was Twitter. And it was kind of fun because it's like it was the olden days of the internet where people could just write what they wanted, when they wanted, under a pen name, and it wasn't pictures, it wasn't videos, it wasn't flashy. It was just, you could just be raw and honest, which is refreshing.
Yeah. Your blog, Darcy Dates, went pretty viral.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, you know, in a huge city like New York City, how often did you have friends who didn't know it was you, but who commented on the blog?
So the funny thing is, I remember once my mom was out somewhere and she mentioned to this girl, this girl that worked for a friend of mine who was, you know, in her 20s. And she said, oh, my daughter writes a blog about dating. You should check it out, Darcy Dates. And she's like, oh my God, I love Darcy Dates. That's your daughter? That's Jenna? You know, so like there was definitely people who didn't know. There was once one guy that figured out I was writing about our date. And here's the greatest story. He found out I was writing because this was back on the days of Facebook where if you liked something on Facebook, it would show your whole feed that you liked it. So I liked Darcy Dates and it alerted it to my feed. And I forgot he was one of my Facebook friends. And he texted me and he was like, I was so mortified when I read it. Oh my God. He's like, but it was so funny and your writing is so good that I'd actually love to take you out again. And I was so flattered. I thought that was the ultimate compliment that he could forgive me because he liked the blog entry so much. But I didn't go out with him again. He was a lovely person. I did not go out with him again. But I started to have men write to me saying, can I take you out on a date to hear what you'd write?
Oh.
And I was like, no, but that's a good idea. I mean, it's good. It's kind of like a review. It's like a Rotten Tomatoes.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, in the beginning of the interview, you talked about how really people are not self-aware. And that shows that people may not be self-aware, but they kind of want to. Like, they want to learn about themselves while they may be hesitant or resistant to change.
Yes, 1,000%. I think it's like anything else. I remember walking with a friend of mine, this was years ago, and she's like, Jenna, she's like, I think you just have to, like, maybe you're just picking the wrong people. You know, maybe you have to look at who you like. It's kind of going back to the type thing. You know, maybe you have to look at your type. Maybe you have to look at, and it resonated with me because I never thought, like, wow, I'm choosing maybe to date the wrong people. And it actually changed the course of my dating because I took a long, hard look at myself and I was like, wait a second, am I turning away actual good quality because I want to choose someone who's more whatever, yeah. You know, so sometimes people don't realize, I think.
So when you changed course, did you find I was getting married
in October.
Oh, congratulations.
So yes, those words were very impactful. No, I'm getting married in October to the most amazing person. I got so incredibly lucky.
Wonderful. How did you meet this person?
I actually met him on Raya, which is a dating app. So dating apps work. Yeah. I would say, even I tell people, like, they're terrible. It's kind of like TJ Maxx. Like, you have to comb through the racks to find that one good shirt from your favorite designer. But they're terrible, but they work. Because I think as you get older, it's not like you go to a bar and everyone's your age and young and single. So you want to find like-minded people who you're aligned with. And the easiest way to do it, I think, is seeing a place where everyone's single.
Yeah. In this day of artificial intelligence, you would think that if you were self-aware and you really knew what you wanted, you could say, hey, ChatGPT, find me a person, or you know, even in some of these dating apps, maybe this exists.
By the way, that's a great idea.
You just describe the kind of person that you want, and they you know, up comes a name, you know, within a 50-mile radius of Park City.
Someone who's single. By the way, there should be, I don't know, but there should be something, you know, an AI thing that combs through a dating app and finds your, I don't know. I don't know enough about technology, but it is a good idea. Or at least ask ChatGPT, you know, who would I be properly aligned with, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. I like that idea. Okay. There's my next idea that I don't bring to fruition.
Exactly. There's so many of them.
Speaking of AI, as a writer, how do you employ it? Do you use it? Do you find it helpful? Do you find it intimidating? Because that's so much of the conversation these days.
Well, it's so funny you asked. I was so late to the AI express. I really was so resistant. I was like, I don't need AI. And I kind of felt like AI was cheating for writing. I felt like AI could never have done what a person does tone-wise. And then I took a look at AI. It's actually fairly recent, about 6 weeks ago, is my first encounter with AI, with ChatGPT, which should probably be embarrassing because people have been using it now, for one or 2 years? I don't even know. But I was blown away. Yeah. I was blown away. And now I find myself using it as a Google. Like, if I can't, if I'm not satisfied with the information I'm getting, am I ready to turn over my writing to it? No. Yeah. And I'll tell you something. I've had a couple instances with other people who use ChatGPT on me. Like, if I, like, a bookstore posted a description about my book and clearly had ChatGPT write it, and it was completely off.
Oh. So you have to read
the
what
caption
you...
actually said, after a string of her, after heartbreak, Darcy goes on dates to only date men with Darcy in their name, which is not the accurate description.
Oh.
And then I was also on a podcast where the woman definitely knew who I was, and she had done tons of research and watched my work, but read like a long intro and definitely had ChatGPT write it. So it started to talk about things I didn't do. So I would say with anything else, check it, like proofread what you're doing. But it's an amazing thing. I've actually been using it for pictures to illustrate what happens in the book. And it's so much fun to illustrate my book with ChatGPT. So I've been exploring that recently.
Well, the book is Darcy Dates. It is by local resident Jenna Kingsley. I'm so happy you could join me in the studio this morning.
I loved it, Lynn. Thanks so much for having me.
Are you a full-time resident?
I am mostly here. I'm mostly full-time here. I go back and forth from New York, and I live sometimes there, but I'm full-time here.
Right. And your fiancé?
We're together, both places, back and forth.
Wonderful. But... Well, what a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you.
I know at your book signings, you've just sold out of the book, both at Dolly's and Barnes & Noble.
I know.
So
it's so, how much fun. People have been so supportive here, so it's so great.
That's great.
Thanks for tuning in to The Mountain Life here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab, or on the KPCW app, or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW The Mountain Life. And if you like today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.